This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian. The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark.
The reason for acting is the very direct threat that ISIL poses to our country and to our way of life.
David Cameron makes a case for bombing ISIS in Syria. But as a vote looms next week, there's chaos in Labour's shadow cabinet as the party attempts to reach a unified position. Also this week, George Osborne's autumn statement saw the Chancellor once again find a reverse gear. Out went the planned cuts to the police force. The departmental spending squeeze has been significantly relieved, and there was a full-on retreat on the plans to savage tax credits. So what does it all mean? And is it really, as some newspapers said, the end of austerity? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian Social Affairs editor, Randeep Ramesh, The Observer's economics editor, Heather Stewart, and The Guardian columnist, John Harris. A warm welcome to you all. Now, for months, David Cameron has wanted to use the RAF to extend Britain's campaign against ISIS from Iraq into Syria. This week, with growing numbers of MPs in support, he laid out his case. ISIS, he said, is a growing threat to Britain and we should not subcontract our security to our allies. He also pointed to intelligence, claiming 70,000 moderate rebels were ready to take advantage of gains made against ISIS, a claim that has been repeatedly challenged and some analysts say is wildly optimistic. But it was an argument that resonated widely in Parliament. And it played well too in the shadow cabinet, which is now horribly split over what to do next. Randy, we can all agree that something must be done about ISIS. This is something, and therefore?
Yeah, it's something, but it's probably the wrong thing. David Cameron, I think, while he looked good delivering it, I think when the words were passed later, he realised he'd conflated two things, or he'd rather linked two things, which are difficult. One is the defanging the immediate threat, which the UK has essentially been doing by drone striking what it sees as threats, whether that's Jihadi John or Junaid Hussein, various ISIS fighters which have been identified as people planning threats right now or a threat to British life. And the other thing is this safe haven. And by sort of linking the two, it broadened the argument to eradicating ISIS, which I think is really problematic. And while it sounds good now and the sort of idea of vengeance and standing by an ally is kind of resonates, it won't do in a month's time when we haven't succeeded and we are left facing a foe which will probably grow stronger. If we really wanted to get ISIS, we could have decapitated the head in Mosul. We have authority to destroy ISIS in Iraq. We haven't done so, and that's where Baghdadi resides or last was seen. So it seems an odd thing. If you want to destroy ISIS, well, you've got the legitimate authority to do so in Iraq. You haven't done that. You're now hoping to extend pinprick strikes in Syria, which I think the Prime Minister could have won if he'd narrowed the debate down to striking in against threats to Britain.
But he is, John, isn't he? He is going to get this vote through, almost certainly. Lots of Labour MPs saying that they're minded to support it, and some of the Tories who were previously against saying in the light of Paris they've changed their mind, I think.
Yes, it feels like that. And in the context of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership and all the underlying tensions that bubble around the Labour Party at the moment, the issues of security and intervention in the Middle East. I mean, I can't think of two issues that were going to polarise the Labour Party more. We're going to send things into more of a spin. And we're going to reinforce this sense you've got now that there isn't really a middle in the Labour Party. What you've got now is the sort of stop the war, Corbyn, McDonnell, Diane Abbott tendency, who I would imagine would be against intervention in Syria in any event. And then you've got people, broadly speaking, on the right of the party who still believe in the credo of liberal interventionism, don't like all these sour notes being sounded about Tony Blair, like what Ken Livingstone said on Question Time last night, and so on. So it's the perfect sort of polarising issue to really bring all those tensions to the fore in the Labour Party, which is what's happening. And looking at it today, sounds a bit melodramatic, but you strongly get the sense that the parliamentary Labour Party is in the process of falling apart.
Heather, I mean, it's, you know, a delicately balanced argument, most MPs were saying before Paris. Militarily, the efficacy or not of these strikes presumably hasn't changed a great deal with what happened in Paris, and yet the mood seems to have done completely, and particularly on the Labour side.
It does, but it's. I don't think we should be terribly surprised that Labour are split on this. I mean, there are the completely legitimate arguments on either side. Randeep's completely right. There doesn't seem to be a clear plan about, you know, how you would widen out what we're already doing in Iraq to create a kind of coherent strategy that would, you know, take out ISIS, as it were. So I don't think it's surprising that Labour are divided on it. But the management of it or the approach to it has been very odd. I mean, if you remember the run-up to the Iraq war vote, you know, Blair's people, admittedly they were in power, of course, but Blair's people were working very hard to try and persuade Labour MPs. There was a kind of very active sort of strategy to sort of set people aside, take them aside one by one, talk them through it, say, what are your concerns? What are your worries? Jeremy Corbyn does this very odd thing yesterday of holding a shadow cabinet minister meeting, clearly very divided, and then sort of sending out this letter to MPs over the head of the shadow cabinet, as far as we could see, which seems to have made the tensions even worse rather than better. I mean, you can understand why he's doing it. He's presumably hoping that local members at home will give their many of whom support him, will give individual MPs a hard time. But it doesn't look like someone who's leading a party. It looks like a kind of protest. It's the way a sort of protest backbencher approach. You know, we've written a protest letter. It doesn't feel like he's trying to lead or he's trying to create a coherent view in his party. It's very odd.
Do you think, Randy, what he's really trying to do is make his own position unambiguously clear to all the people who voted for him and stop the war and everything else before he has to do a political thing of conceding a free vote that he's on the record as saying he doesn't want to give, he'd like to whip MPs against it?
Yeah, I think there's no option but for a free vote unless he wants to see half the shadow cabinet resign. I think that the thing for them is they haven't seen the motion, and that's what Hilary Benn was on the telly last night saying, well, we've got to see the motion before we start deciding how we vote for this stuff.
Well, it has to be said, before we just say it's all on Jeremy's freewheeling on his own, Hilary Benn was on the telly saying David Cameron's made a compelling case. Once you've said that about a prime minister who's taking a momentous decision, it's quite hard then to go against them.
Yeah, I think, the trouble for the Labour Party is, remember, the original compelling case was based on the idea of safe havens for, you know, people fleeing ISIS. That was what the protectorate system was supposed to be, and we would patrol them like we did in Iraq in the 38th parallel, sort of 20 years ago. So that was where I think the mindset of the Labour Party has been, it's kind of outrun, the argument's outrun that mindset. And they're sort of struggling, I think, to keep up. You know, 35 pages this morning, they get briefings where they're told, you know, imminent threat. And really what Cameron's doing is he's broadened it to give him, you know, a free hand in Syria, which is not what I think the Labour Party should be doing. The problem for the shadow cabinet is, I think, is they're just reacting to Corbyn's own kind of left-wingery, which is they want to drag him into the centre ground, into where they think the British people are. And he's kind of not having any of it.
And his position is legitimate, is it not? I mean, it's not obvious to me that.
His position is legitimate in the sense that it's thought through, and he's the leader of the Labour Party.
Yeah.
But the difficulty for the Labour Party to have this argument is what I said earlier, which is that one gets the strong sense. In fact, I think we can safely say that it's true that Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell, Diane Abbott certainly would be against any kind of military intervention in any event, wherever it happened. And that makes any sort of compromise position and pulling the leadership somehow towards what Randeep called the centre almost impossible. I mean, that's the nature of their predicament.
And it also undermines the power of your argument in a way, because you surrender the authority to pick over the details.
Yeah, I mean, Corbyn has come the sort of liberal, what was the Liberal Democrat line on Iraq so far? The language that he's used has been that the Prime Minister hasn't yet made a convincing case. Well, you're not going to convince Jeremy Corbyn of the case for military intervention in the Middle East. You're not.
But, I mean, he's obviously using that language, John, because he's got a lot of kind of middle-of-the-road MPs who, you know, they're almost certainly, if we are heading towards a free vote, there's going to be quite a number of people beyond the 20 or so who are loyally with him in his faction, as he put it, who he needs to side with him to bolster his authority a bit. I mean, do you have any sense of the proportion of MPs that might go with him if he can give a slightly more, if he can get that tone right?
It's hard to tell, because the people that you'll be talking about will be people, a lot of them anyway, will be those sort of stereotypical MPs who don't necessarily have particularly deep convictions one way or the other on this, but, you know, put an emphasis on party loyalty and being seen to do the right thing by the leaders. So we don't know yet, you know.
And
the new intake will be the ones to look at, I suppose. And then also there'll be a hell of a lot of people who do feel that the argument is compelling, that somehow the Labour Party, penetrating light is being shone on where the Labour Party is at and the extent to which it's playing to left-wing type, not terribly productively in terms of its popularity. And a lot of MPs will not like that, and therefore I would imagine, given the chance, will go the Hillary Benn way.
And if Randeep, as you predict, this thing's going to go ahead and it's not going to work very well and we'll still be bombing in 6 months' time, Jeremy Corbyn's got this big crisis now, but could it look like he was the wise one who saw where it was all going to pan out and a lot of his MPs were wrong?
Well, I think two competing timescales. One is the May elections next year, with Labour mayoral elections and the local elections, and how long the public give bombing Iraq and Syria together to eradicate ISIL. I think that the public will realise later than the May elections that this has been a disaster. You only have to look at how many strikes the Americans have made in Iraq. I think it's 8,000 sorties, and they've hit something like 190 tanks. I mean, they hit motorbikes a lot of the time. It's, you know, it's a far cry from what David Cameron, as leader of the opposition, called, you know, dropping bombs to deliver liberty. And this is the problem, is that it kind of disappears from the public's mind until something terrible happens. And then people say, well, hang on, what the hell have we been doing there for these last few months? So I think, you know, Corbyn's in a tighter position because he really has a much shorter time frame to kind of change the Labour Party.
But he is representing a very large number of new members of the party who sort of, you know, swelled local parties in recent months, and who you would imagine probably feel quite strongly that with him, that any intervention in the Middle East would be unwise, you know.
John, do you think it's possible it will, you know, there'll be a free vote and it will kind of dissipate a little bit? There's no way out apart from a free vote, is there? Because otherwise he'd be losing half his shadow cabinet. He'd have no one to replace it with.
No, and then clearly, as Randeep says, that the crucial factor then is what exactly is the effect one way or the other of airstrikes and so on. But I think that, I mean, if there's a sizable, and I would imagine there will be, if there's a sizable number of MPs who vote against what we can only call the Corbyn line on this issue, I think that will be damaging, because you'll then clearly, you've then got something to focus on endlessly, all the elements of the media that are hostile to Corbyn, or, you know, just in the standard of, in the course of ordinary political journalism, you've got a sense then of exactly how split the PLP is, and this sense that he might be the leader, but he's not in charge. And I think you've got a profound symbol of it. Also, the other thing to watch, which is going to land in the midst of all this, is the Oldham West by-election on Thursday. You know, this is all going to lead to a very, very difficult spell for Corbyn, which I think might be one of those occasions looking ahead where, you know, you end up like Ian Duncan Smith. You know, there's only so much damage someone can take. Because it feels like this stuff, these damaging episodes, which seem to underline the sense that he's not in control, it almost feels to me now like they're happening on a daily basis.
Mm. And he was meant to go up to Oldham, wasn't he, today? And he's, you know.
Yeah, so there you are. There's the two issues.
He's come back down to Westminster, or stayed in Westminster, to focus on party management.
I mean, I suppose a lot depends, though, John, in terms of whether this resonates in Oldham and just how much news people do or don't watch. If everyone had Five Live on all the time in the Today programme in the morning, they might think, oh, I'm not voting for Labour while Corbyn's in charge, but, you know, because it's too chaotic. But do you think this far out from an election, most people might just be completely detuned from politics? So it wouldn't affect the way they'd vote?
One always has to think that, particularly with reference to by-elections, where turnout might not be that high. But clearly UKIP in the Oldham West by-election are really, really hammering this idea that Corbyn is not patriotic, that there are questionable things as regards his view of foreign affairs, his, you know, his backstory with the IRA and all that stuff. So it's sort of in the air. You have a party, as UKIP would, which is very forcefully, shamelessly, some would say, really, really pushing that. The other thing that I think gives the question of Syria a greater resonance is just the fact that in Oldham you've got a very, very sizable population who are Muslim. So it makes it more of a live issue than if you were having a by-election in Milton Keynes, for example.
Well, we'll be back this time next week to talk about the fallout from Oldham, when we should know the result. And in the meantime, you can follow the evolving story, both militarily and in political terms, as that vote on Syria approaches, at theguardian.com.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
I've been asked to help in the transition as Britain moves to the higher wage, lower welfare, lower tax society that the country wants to see. And I've had representations that these changes to tax credits should be phased in. I've listened to the concerns, I hear and understand them, and because I've been able to announce today an improvement in the public finances, the simplest thing to do is not to phase these changes in, but to avoid them altogether.
So there it was. With one bound, he was free. Planned cuts to tax credits that would have hit working people by up to £1,300 next year have been abandoned, for now at least, after a combined opposition from tabloid newspapers, backbench Tories and Labour peers. The autumn statement that had once threatened to take a machete to government spending ended up with a plan that some people are saying wasn't too different from the austerity light that was offered by Ed Miliband and Ed Balls in the run-up to the general election. Heather, is that a fair characterisation?
Yeah, I think it is. It always, the cuts that Osborne was suggesting, certainly those in the March budget, but also in the July budget, were very deep, and many people said implausibly deep. But he was handed a really lucky break, really, by the Office for Budget Responsibility, the independent body that sets forecasts, which has, you know, redone its forecasts of taxation and expects £27 billion more in revenues over the next 5 years or so. So it's not that surprising that he had to soften the blow in some ways, but he was given a kind of get out of jail free card, really, by these radical changes in the forecast.
But do you remember there were changes in the July budget, there were changes in March, and if you go right back to this time last year, Randeep, there was headlines about road to Wigan Pier because public spending was going to be rolled back to 1937 levels. You know, it's been a story of retreats ever since, while he still remains this great kind of supposedly credible chancellor.
Yeah, I don't know when the shine comes off, to be honest, but I mean, he's sort of, as Heather said, you know, bought off the British public with £27 billion, which found loose change back of the sofa. Of course, when Ed Balls proposed, you know, a £30 billion hole, as it was going to be chaos. When the Labour Party proposed upping corporation tax, it was the end of capitalist Britain.
There was a lot of tax raising in this statement, yeah, as well. That's another thing that we shouldn't forget.
So, I mean, the Chancellor is, you know, slapped £3 billion on companies. It's not the end of the world for them. The Chancellor has raided the housing market, not on, you know, in a not dissimilar way,
yep,
to a mansion tax.
Yep.
You know, yep. And there's not the end of the world. The Chancellor has delayed all his welfare changes. I mean, there are two problems with this. One, well, the three problems. One is this is still a deficit-financed recovery in some sense. We're still borrowing loads as households, and that will be a problem that will come home to roost if interest rates go up. You know, we've still got big welfare changes to come in, and we're still shrinking the state to 36% of GDP. So at some stage, unless the Chancellor weaves his magic again and says, I tell you what, I'm not going to be in surplus, because that's what happened last time.
Which is what we were expecting him to do. He's building up a £10 billion war chest by 2020. We were, before we knew about these OBR forecast changes, we were expecting him to have to spend that to get him out of the hole that he got himself into with the tax credit changes.
But, I mean, John, we can kind of criticise him for, you know, saying he'd do one thing and then turning out to do another. But there's, you know, he's just tacking to the centre ground, and it's probably not a bad place for him to be, is it?
No, I'm not buying this increasing consensus that austerity is now on the back burner and he's on the centre ground. Because the reality of it, I mean, I've got a big piece in the paper and online today about the predicament of, and I don't even want to say local councils or local government, because that's not really the issue. You're talking about lots and lots of public services. Things we used to expect as a matter of course to be sort of part of the social fabric, that are going to experience huge cuts in the next 4 or 5 years, on top of the 4 or 5 that they've already experienced. And on top of that, you've got a revolution in the way that local government and, by extension, local services are financed, which is going to be much less redistributive, which is going to make life for councils and, by extension, people in the wealthier areas of the country much better than people in very, very struggling, cash-strapped areas of the country. And this is a huge change. But because when we say local government, a lot of media people's eyes glaze over and they just think we're just going to talk about dustbins or something, not enough attention's being paid to it. I couldn't believe it when I walked in the newsagent on Thursday morning and the Telegraph said the end of austerity and the Daily Mail said whatever happened to austerity. Simply isn't the case. Austerity is ongoing.
So just give us a sense then of, because in the last Parliament there was definitely this kind of like lots of doom mongering on the financial pages, but the voting public in the end didn't think that services had been savaged enough to boot the Tories out. But what services is it that you think specifically are going to cease to function in the next few years or cease to function as we know it?
Well, there are two aspects to this. Clearly, the number of people who have direct experience of social care, both for adults and children, at any given time is relatively small.
Yeah.
Now, if you talk to people in local and city government, I like to call it city government, now it sounds a bit more important, local and city government, about social care, they're now starting to drill into those budgets because things are getting so tight. So lots of people's vulnerable people's care packages are being reassessed. Things like charges for Meals on Wheels are going up. The number of visits that you'll be able to receive, say, if you're a vulnerable elderly person, is going to go down in lots of places. So that's all going to happen. Now, I would argue that it's probably the case that everybody knows somebody or has a familial relationship with somebody who is a beneficiary of social care. So I think that's going to become a huge issue. We all know there's this great big care gap looming. The effects of the government's Care Act in terms of making councils do more reassessments is going to be huge. The living wage is going to hit the care sector like a hammer. So I think all that may yet explode in Osborne's face.
It's striking, isn't it? Like this week, he's got these good headlines, Heather, about, you know, you said it was going to be a catastrophe and now it's only a mini catastrophe in terms of these spending cuts. But if now you've got newspapers running headlines saying the end of austerity, that rather deft expectation management's gone into a dangerous reverse for him, hasn't it?
Mm. Yeah, and you know, we were talking about it before we started, but as a kind of news writer, you find yourself using July as the baseline and saying, oh, things are better than they've looked. But actually, if you step back and you think about it in historical terms, we're still looking at a kind of unprecedented 10-year period of pretty much flat real spending, which, you know, we just haven't seen. We haven't, you know, haven't seen it at all in the post-war period. And John's right. Some of these things are a kind of slower burner than, I mean, you notice your library closing or you notice your Sure Start Centre closing. But, you know, it takes time for, you know, reading John's piece this morning, it takes time for the parks to start looking tatty and the school buildings to start looking tatty and the, you know, and it's hard to know when that starts to bite. But the tax credit issue, which the public clearly felt very strongly about and MPs realised they were going to feel very strongly about, shows you that people can get angry and decide that these things are unacceptable quite quickly. You know, there are things that the public will eventually, you know, decide they can't put up with. And whether it's, you might get more pressure on prisons, for example, which are under huge pressure, you know, a huge prison riot or a, you know, it's hard to know where it's going to bubble up. But after a long period where the easy cuts have already been made, it's going to be tough. It's going to be a very tough 5 years, I think.
Randy, you've keep a close eye on one area of spending that's meant to be not only protected, but spending is going up, which is the health service. And yet, the increase is something like 3% over 5 years, where historically it would have expected 3% a year. How rough a ride is it going to be in A&E's, do you think?
I think it'll be a disaster. I don't think the government's, you know, idea behind a lot of this stuff is to increase the productivity, as they describe it, of public services. And they see only one way of doing that, which is essentially to cut budgets or cap them. And that forces, they think, a behavioural change within organisations. But it hasn't. And in the NHS is a classic example where what you're seeing is, if you look at something like dermatology, which used to be a what they call a secondary function, i.e. within hospitals, and is often related to poverty, that function is no longer being delivered within hospitals. And with its disappearance, you're seeing the emergence of a large private sector in dermatology, for example, which, you know, people are having to pay £160 a consultation for, which they would have been free. And that sort of is what's happening. There's this kind of ending of services that were once free, moving them over to the private sector, you can still get dermatological treatment. You just have to wait a year for it before people raise their eyebrows.
But aren't there targets? I mean, until 2014, they got away with hitting most of the kind of inherited targets, didn't they, on waiting lists, A&E times and all of that. Are they now wildly slipping off on the...
They've just disbanded target. I mean, there's this other great myth about the target culture. So in every sphere, as John's absolutely right, social care is an absolute disaster. And so the precept, putting 2% on local councils to pay for it raises 1.75 billion, I think the LGA said. That's no
way. Which probably won't be in the places it's most needed anyway.
It won't be. It'll be in rich councils, just have very low council tax. They've rechanged the health funding formula to take account of that. They're trying to direct more money to older people. But really, it's just not enough.
I mean, the health service is a very relevant point to bring up when you're talking about cuts that are being delegated to local government. Really good examples of this. When I was in Newcastle, for example, they have a team of social workers that works out of hospitals. So when an elderly person gets discharged from hospital, they make sure that their transition back to home is okay. Now, because of cuts, they're probably going to have to get rid of most of those social workers. So people are going to end up staying longer in hospital. Similarly, the public health grant, which is a 2.6 billion grant, which is given to councils to work on things like teenage pregnancy and drug and alcohol abuse. It's all about prevention, right? Osborne's done away with that. And again, it's something very little of the media realised. He's done away with that. Councils are going to have to find the money for that out of business rates from 2020 onwards. Now, if you get rid of preventive services, we all know what happens. You get lots and lots of emergencies and the health service gets hit like a hammer.
But, this is part of the government strategy, is that, even with social care, the Tories' idea was you buy your own insurance. It's a behavioural thing. With preventative strategies, they just don't believe the state has a role to it. It's ideological. They think that the individual should discover that themselves, not to smoke, not to eat fatty foods. But it's a total misunderstanding the way people live their lives in places, because there only is kind of junk food around in a poor area. There only is.
And yet,
Heather,
what would the alternative be? I mean, it sounds like they're already shifting in terms of the scale of the cuts towards what Labour was saying. They've been criticised a lot this week for spending a large portion of this 27 billion that turned up on the back of the sofa courtesy of the Bean Council, the Office for Budget Responsibility. Is there an economic argument that they should be doing something radically different?
There's a strong economic argument that you would spend more money up front on investment. It's exceedingly cheap for the government to borrow at the moment.
Run a higher deficit than Osborne is.
Yeah, pay the debt off, but pay it off more slowly. There's very little mainstream economic support for the idea that you've got to clear the deficit over a magic 5 years. And actually, he claimed he was going to clear it in the last parliament, and actually was kind of sensible and flexible and pragmatic enough not to do so, because if he had cut more deeply when the economy turned down, it would have been disastrous. So, you just relax about it and don't have a kind of cultish target of we've got to run a surplus in 2020.
So. And the argument they have for that is, well, if we get another crisis, I don't know, coming out of China or the Eurozone or something, we need to make sure our overdraft's small enough that we can respond then. Do you sympathise with that? Or?
There is something in that, but they're also ignoring various other ways in which you would want the economy to be prepared. So household debt, for example, has been rising and is due to continue rising. It's heading, but it's lower than it was pre-crisis, but it's heading back in that direction. And actually, one of the things you also want if a crisis hits is for households not to be too heavily indebted, but actually, we're going around with Help to Buy scheme, for example, encouraging people to take on more debt. So, right. He's sort of fixated on the public sector debt, which is one aspect of these things, but neglecting a lot of other measures of how well prepared the economy might be when the next crisis comes, which it will.
I mean, it dripped this week's statement, I thought, John, with much more politics than economics. It was all like, oh, please, Labour have been talking about how we're going to have to cut that by a quarter, and now we're not going to have to cut it at all. Politically, do you think it leaves Osborne looking much more likely to be the next tenant of Number 10?
Well, I think the tax cuts U-turn increases the sense or restores the sense that he is a very, very, very serious contender. Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think the other part of the politics of all this, though, that we haven't mentioned is this question looking ahead of if the idea that the end of austerity is a load of rubbish and austerity is really going to carry on biting, whether there'll be any political payback for that. That again comes back to the current state of the Labour Party. That's what I mean. That personally is what I find quite sort of painful and upsetting looking at all this, is knowing that this stuff is glaring. It's obvious, it's going to be absolutely awful to see it, let alone experience it, but wondering whether it'll actually have any sort of meaningful political traction, because the Labour Party is in this state of absolute introversion. It's just staring at itself, falling out all the time. And prior to Syria coming along, we're sort of picking fights with itself on stuff which I feel quite strongly about personally, but which is largely irrelevant. You know, now is not the time to be tearing yourself apart about Trident. I want a party to speak about the unfairness of what George Osborne is doing, and I don't really feel I'm getting it, which is why John McDonnell throwing around Mao's red book was sort of symbolic, because it looked like someone sort of faffing around when they should have been doing something serious that would have a lasting political
effect. Making a positive case that there's an alternative way of doing things, and there is, and that, but you're not... They're getting absolutely no play.
No, I mean,
with that
if you watch McDonald, I mean, if you want to go through the pain of watching McDonald's 22-minute response to the autumn statement, which I wouldn't advise anyone to do, I did it yesterday. There's no through line to his argument to speak of. He doesn't mention the fact that the government is cutting the revenue support grant for local authorities, Labour local authorities. The Labour Party runs just about all the cities in England by 56% up to 2020. He didn't mention that. So there's this sort of sense of the Labour Party being all over the place. And in times like these, although there are deep, deep reasons for the fact that the Labour Party is all over the place, that's the last thing that we need.
Randeep, a final word. Do you think Labour's got a chance to start making this argument in the next year or two as the austerity, I think we're agreed, is still going to happen as it begins to bite?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Labour Party elected Corbyn and MacDonald in a period of grief, and maybe that's the wrong thing to have done. But I do think there's one thing that has been proved about their project, which is Labour leadership lost connection with its base. It needs to reconnect. It needs to find some way. Although I really have a lot of time for Liz Kendall and Yvette and Andy. They were all great candidates. They would have struggled in this period to have found room politically to outmaneuver George Osborne. They're too similar in many respects. They sound too similar, they feel too similar. Many of the policies in the last budget, as we discussed, were balls. So you sort of sense that the Labour Party needs to define itself in a different way. It's on a long journey. Let's hope that they find it pretty soon.
But our journey's over for this week. So thanks very much to Randeep, to John and to Heather. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
The Guardian.